This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Over the past year, Newsmakers has explored many of the issues, good and bad, facing the region's growing population of people 65 and older. Our goal has been to help not only those who are aging into a senior lifestyle, but also the families, friends, and professionals who work to help seniors address the challenges and joys they experience. We wanted to explore how Wisconsin and neighboring states are prepared to support this aging population, a demographic that's growing disproportionately to the population overall.
Part of the issue, of course, is that the baby boomers who are now 51 to 69 years old are moving into those older ages.
Susan Brower is Minnesota's state demographer.
But if you look kind of longer term, this is a trend that really has its basis in the fact that we have long life expectancies and relatively low birth rates. So eventually we would have gotten to an older society anyway, but the baby boomers kind of helped us along.
A couple of things I'd like to add.
This is Carrie Mulkey. She's the director of the Wisconsin Bureau of Aging and Disability.
I think it's important to realize that population aging is not new. It's actually been underway since the 1900s, and it's quite fascinating to see how just over the course of one decade, life expectancies increased by 30 years. So to the point, most babies in 1900 didn't live past age 50, and now we're seeing life expectancy at birth now exceeding 80 years, at least here in Wisconsin. And that's a pretty consistent nationwide statistic as well. And I think the baby boomers are, as was mentioned by Susan, is certainly something that's contributing to this phenomenon. But there's some other pieces, too. I think you mentioned infant survival. I would add things like public health, nutrition, sanitation. And I like to frame population aging as a public health success. Preventive medical care, medical advances, acute medical care, and decreasing poverty are all things that are contributing to this increase in life expectancy, but it isn't a new phenomenon.
Carrie Mulkey is director of the Wisconsin Bureau of Aging and Disability. Our aging population may be attributed to public health success, as Mulkey says. Improved nutrition, sanitation, and public health services, gains in preventive medical care, and decreases in poverty. But that's not to say aging doesn't still have its challenges. For many, it's the basics of day-to-day living, housing, and transportation. Not surprisingly, most seniors would prefer to stay in their homes, surrounded by the neighbors and businesses they're most familiar with.
We find ourselves having to have conversations with seniors about, is this the best housing choice for you? We understand that this is where you've lived most of your life. This is where you've raised your children, where you have friends in the community. But do you have the income to maintain this asset? Do you have the cash flow to support this house? Do you need the four-bedroom, three-bedroom house? And it is a challenge.
Todd Mandel is with Cooley Cap, a multi-county community action agency serving people in poverty, promoting self-sufficiency, and assisting vulnerable members of our communities. While finding affordable housing is often identified as a challenge for seniors, Mandel also points out growing preferences to stay in an existing home, which presents its own set of challenges.
Our most significant work, though, really comes in doing rehabilitation services for seniors who own their housing. Rehab needs in housing stock in rural Wisconsin is a significant crisis. And then that crisis is only compounded when you focus simply on the senior subset. Right now, we, based on our own internal waiting list of people waiting for housing assistance, we would need probably $9 or $10 million to completely wipe out that waiting list, and based on our own experience, within a year that waiting list would repopulate. Probably a half of that, 50% of that waiting list is seniors, and so they represent about a $5 million unfunded liability in our rural communities. And you know, we're trying to tackle that problem basically at 10% of that funding every year if we're lucky. And so it's a real challenge. Seniors are holding on to those houses until they're 80 or 85 years old. And it's, we understand, partly, if for no other reason, they're doing it because that house, especially for low-income families, that house represents almost their entire wealth. And so they don't have much wealth to pass along to the next generation, and they're afraid that if they liquidate that wealth now, it'll get chewed up in housing and senior costs, and they won't have anything to pass along to their children. And it represents, in many cases, literally the only thing they have to pass along to their children.
And so when you're talking about, you know, these kind of housing rehabilitation, you know, are you talking about specifically just for preparing a house maybe to be sold, or is it just, you know, repairing a house so a senior can continue occupying that house?
It is many facets. So it's many times it's dealing with years of deferred maintenance, whether that's plumbing that's been bad for a long time or a basement that's been falling apart for a long time, but now it's failing because they just haven't had the money to deal with that leak. Whether it's a roof that has been leaking for a while, and now that small leak is a big leak, and that big leak has gone ahead and impacted a number of other systems. Whether it's critical systems that have fallen apart, the electrical was 60 amp to start with, and they've been trying to run a 200 amp household off it, and they've been they've been threatened with a condemnation order, or their plumbing doesn't meet code. In rural communities, well water is a ridiculous level problem. We have so many seniors with fouled wells, non-functional wells. Every year we have at least 10 stories of seniors who are trucking water from their neighbor's house a quarter, a half, a mile, 2 miles away because they don't have potable water, and it's not cheap. It's $15,000 depending on in some of these communities if they're up on a ridge to get to a well or a septic system. Increasing enforcement of environmental laws obviously are important, but they have ramifications, right? And so that septic system that worked 2 years ago no longer now fails and has to be replaced. And without it, it's a condemnation order. So the, you know, increasing health and safety codes and the enforcement of those codes is a good thing. We support it. It needs to happen. At the same time, there are real implications when that happens in rural communities where folks just don't have the assets and the cash. And they can't just go to a bank and get a home equity loan because they don't have the cash flow to support that. They can get a reverse mortgage, but reverse mortgages are tricky. We don't have a lot of lenders in this area that do them, and they are open and ripe for abuse by predatory and non-ethical lenders.
Todd Mandel is with the community action agency Cooley Cap. Independent living also means having to find one's own way to get around. And for many seniors, nothing says independence in rural Wisconsin like driving. Viterbo University professor Dr. Stephanie Thorson Olson has been researching the challenges of aging since finding herself in a caretaker's role. And she says changing transportation needs are high on the list. As an illustration, she shared a family story about growing older and keeping a driver's license.
It is so difficult, and it is especially difficult if you live in a rural area. So, for example, here's a little personal story for you. I'm from a small town of about 1,000 people, and my grandparents live there, and they live in their own home. And my grandpa, he worked until he was 86 years old. And even when he'd get done working for the family construction company, he would go home and he mows the lawn himself. He goes for a walk around town. He's just a really independent, hardworking guy. And so it was really tough to see his health decline. And the family decided that, you know, we need to strategize to try and help, you know, Grandpa, and he needs to drive a little bit less. He'd had some run-ins and things weren't going so well. So they took his keys away, and everybody was trying the best that they could to still get my grandparents out to different functions and things like that. But it's tough. One day, Grandma called, and Grandpa's 93 now, but Grandma called, and she was just frantic. Here, Grandpa had hot-wired his own car, and he took off, and she was all worried about where he might be. And so all the family rushes to town to look for Grandpa. Where is he at? And he is just a few blocks away at the local convenience store having a coffee and visiting. He just wanted to get down the street for his 10 a.m. coffee like he used to do with his buddies. And that was it.
being in a rural community, or, you know, even people who live out in the country. I mean, these, you know, they don't have access to public transportation like larger cities do. I mean, how does that impact their transportation situation?
It really makes an impact. So one of the classes that I teach is a leadership and advocacy class. And during the semester, I challenge my students to find something that they're passionate about and to advocate for it. But in doing that, they have to really understand the problem. So one of my students had this service that was available in her county, and they live in a rural area. And it was a bus in that small town that would bring you to appointments and bring you to the larger city and bring you to Madison. And it was a really nice service, but it was grant funded. And that grant was about to expire. So she wanted to capture the experience of what kind of a service this provides. So she decided to ride the bus. And one day she got on the bus and she took notes of everybody that got on and off and where they were headed. And it was doctor appointments. It was going to meet friends. It was going to get groceries. It was all those things, going to have a driver's license renewed. And so she made all these notes and kept track of it and what it would mean to lose that service. And so now she's advocating for a continuation of that grant money, and I'm really hopeful that it comes through.
I mean, how often is that the reality for a lot of these programs for seniors, that they rely heavily on grant money or other that sort of funding that's in some ways temporary?
It's a huge reality. And that's why it's really important for people to advocate for others and to recognize, you know, what a huge part services like this play. You know, in the instance of, you know, my grandpa and just wanting to get out there and to visit with others, that social impact of being able to visit with others is so crucial, so important. And that's one small piece of the puzzle. That's not even considering the doctor appointments and the other important appointments people have to make. And so it's really important that people look at things like that that are temporary and that do need someone to advocate for them to continue.
Dr. Stephanie Thorson Olson is a professor at Viterbo University. She shared findings from her research on aging issues and her own personal experiences during our year-long series on aging. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Turning 62 traditionally opened the door to retirement as Social Security becomes an available source of income. But the laws and the practical financial needs of many have increasingly pushed that to 65, 70, or even later, as we learned during a panel discussion with Erica DeWald of the Wisconsin Senior Employment Program, Catholic Charities Executive Director Roberto Partero, and WPR On Your Money co-host and financial planner Kevin McKinley.
Well, money is obviously the biggest factor, also it's lifestyle. And a lot of people who have been fortunate enough to accumulate enough money to retire still have a difficult time transforming from being a worker and a saver to a retiree and a spender. And so not only do people have to deal with how much money they have and whether it's enough to support themselves as long as they should live, which is another undefined figure, but also they have to adjust to this different phase of life where they're not just getting up to go to work every single day. They have to find new things to do to occupy themselves and still feel like they're doing something constructive.
Right. And you mentioned that it's undefined how long a person might live when they're thinking about retiring, or, you know, sometimes it's hard to foresee certain health issues that might be a strain on your finances. You know, is it hard with all of these undetermined things?
Absolutely. And as a rule of thumb, people should generally have about 300 times their net monthly expenses to feel like they can retire comfortably and be financially independent. And to figure that out and check it for yourself, take the amount of money you plan to spend in retirement and then subtract any income you have coming in, like a Social Security or a pension payment. And that net amount, you should have at least 300 times amount to be financially independent. And at a minimum, if you're going to just retire and you're going to have, you know, maybe 20 years of life expectancy after retirement, you have want to have at least 200 times that figure. So if you're spending, let's say, $5,000 a month and you're expecting $2,000 coming in from Social Security in retirement, that leaves $3,000 that needs to be covered. And if you multiply it by 200, you should have about $600,000 set aside. And if you multiply it by 300, you should have about $900,000 set aside.
And from your perspective, is it harder now to successfully retire at 65, or are people having to work longer?
I think people have to work longer in part because they're more uncertain about their retirement performance. You know, in 20 or 30 years ago, you could put all of your money into a certificate of deposit and be assured an interest rate return of maybe 8 to 10% a year. Now, not only can you not get those kinds of returns, but if you try to get them via investing in the stock market, it's much more uncertain. And people who live through the various stock market crunches, crashes, and corrections over the last several years are concerned that that might happen again just as they're about to retire.
And Roberto, you know, how common is it that, you know, you see seniors that don't have enough saved away for retirement and are needing to seek help?
It's pretty common. We serve in the La Crosse area alone. We serve over 270 people, seniors, that come for us for assistance. So it is prevalent, and they need all kinds of help. It's either transportation or food or financial assistance. So it is common, and it is common to see them trying to retain a job or look for a permanent job for a longer period of time. So the idea that we retire at 65, I think that's old-fashioned. In my experience, they're all trying to, if they're healthy, they try to keep working.
And what are the biggest financial factors that seniors are facing? I mean, is it housing that is costing them the most, or medications?
By far, housing. Low-income housing is definitely not available. I mean, if you look at a senior that lives on a Social Security income of about $1,000, and the lowest income housing that you find in the area for one apartment, it's about $620. So they spend over 60% of their income in housing. So as we heard, they have to make some very tough choices. It's housing or food or pay the medical bills or pay the utilities. Or if they're driving, the car breaks down. So it is very difficult for them.
And Erica, I see you shaking your head agreeing over here. I mean, are these things that you also see, are they challenging the people that you work with?
I do see actually a lot more women. Their spouse has deceased, and they're finding that the pension, the investments aren't covering either the mortgage or the utilities, and it's just not enough. And so I have been bringing some participants on who are coming back to the workplace after, 25 years of not being in the workplace. And it's a very different setting for them to come in and not have that computer experience, which computers are such a big part of our environment and our workplace.
That's Erica DeWald from the Wisconsin Senior Employment Program. Our panel also included financial planner Kevin McKinley, a co-host of WPR's On Your Money, and Executive Director Roberto Partereau of Catholic Charities in La Crosse. Not only do seniors need to pay attention to how they manage their finances, but they increasingly have to pay attention to how others would like to manage their money, particularly as it relates to being scammed. And unfortunately, as was alluded to earlier in the program, housing can be another source of being taken advantage of. And then there's the issue of mistreatment from a friend or a loved one. Collectively, these cases of what we call elder abuse are increasing, but still only 1 in 14 cases of elder abuse is ever reported. many communities in the Cooley region are increasing efforts to recognize and reduce elder abuse. One such example is in Trempealeau County, as we learned in this conversation with Marit Peterson from the Minnesota Elder Justice Center, Harlan Reinders with the Trempealeau County Sheriff's Department, and Kathy Gogger, supervisor with Trempealeau County's Aging and Disability Resource Center, who says they're now beginning to see an increase in reported cases of elder abuse.
For numerous reasons, one, there are definitely more elderly people now than there used to be. It's an area of age group that's growing rapidly. We're talking about by 2030, 72.1 million older Americans, and it will comprise 20%. So we're going to continue to see an increase in those numbers.
You know, a lot of times with issues of domestic abuse, it's, you know, difficult to talk about. People often don't report it. Harlan, do you feel like people are aware that this is a problem?
You know, generally speaking, probably not. You know, when you think about it, a lot of these are private issues. And, you know, people are embarrassed about stuff like this. And when you're talking about financial issues where maybe there's some type of fraud involved or something like that, you know, people are embarrassed to say that they kind of got duped. You know what I mean? And the thing is with the generation that's older, they come from a trusting generation. And, you know, when somebody gives you a handshake, it's their word, and you trust what they have to say. And so when they run into people that are, you know, con artists and looking for a scam and a quick buck, they believe those people can be trusted. And so what happens is they're a little embarrassed when it happens. And so maybe the family doesn't report it because their wishes are that they don't say anything.
And Marit, you know, who are the common culprits of elder abuse?
Yeah, excellent question. I think, you know, statistics show that 2/3 of cases of elder abuse are perpetrated by a person who could be considered a trusted individual in the life of the victim. So whether that might be a family member or a caregiver, regardless, it's somebody who occupies a position of trust. And then that would leave the remaining 1/3 of cases to be perpetrated by strangers. So we really are looking at crimes that are often taking place at the hands of a person who could be a family member, could be a caregiver, and in any cases, a person that has a relationship of trust with a victim.
Marit Peterson, Harlan Reinders, and Kathy Gogger are all working on ways to address instances of elder abuse in Western Wisconsin. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. We're revisiting highlights from our year-long focus on issues and challenges facing this region's aging population, a growing challenge thanks to the number of baby boomers aging into their 60s and 70s. There are many decisions that seniors and their families can make on their own. Already we've looked at housing, transportation, and finances. There are, however, a number of issues that are dependent on those in government, both at the federal and statewide levels. In this year's election season, these issues often didn't receive the attention or discussion they arguably deserve, according to Jim Flaherty from the Wisconsin's AARP.
We certainly are not hearing position on critical issues that are important to seniors, particularly Social Security. This is a program that's going to run out of 25% of its money by 2034, and people are going to be facing drastic cuts. And so it's not a joking matter. It's not a laughing matter. It's not public theater TV. This is a real issue that's going to – people live on Social Security to get by. We've all been paying into that program our entire working lives, and we deserve it to be there. So more than anything, Social Security is the number one issue we're hearing about. The state of Wisconsin has a wonderful program called Senior Care, which is a Medicaid program. It's a prescription drug program for folks 65 and over. And Senior Care does allow – the state of Wisconsin can negotiate for lower drug prices, which keeps that program extremely affordable, which is much different than the Medicare Part D program nationwide, which does not have the ability to negotiate for lower prescription drug prices. So AARP is going to be very vigilant at the Wisconsin state level to make sure that senior care, the waiver to allow the senior care program in Wisconsin is extended beyond its sunset date. And the other thing would be to advocate in favor of the state accepting Medicaid expansion money. We infusing more money into that program is going to help thousands of Wisconsin residents who have trouble affording their payments to be able to get by month to month. I got to tell you, there's rural parts of Wisconsin we go to where seniors tell us they have to choose between paying rent or paying health care. They're cutting their drugs in half because they can't make ends meet. You know, it's happening right under our noses in Wisconsin. So we got to provide some help for these folks.
Jim Flaherty is with the nonpartisan advocacy organization AARP Wisconsin. The group represents the needs of Wisconsin's retired and senior populations to state and federal candidates and recently elected officials. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Coming up, the growing issue of dementia and the challenges of being a caregiver as we continue our look at aging in our region. Plus, how the arts and an active lifestyle can benefit people as they grow older, and cultural differences in aging when Newsmakers continues in just a minute. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, WPR.org/newsmakers. You'll also find links to all of the shows in our aging series. Our site also has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at WPR.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. We're in the midst of reviewing and putting into perspective a variety of issues related to our growing population of people 65 and older, topics addressed during our series of monthly programs aired during 2016. We'll focus next on the many challenges related to dementia, one of the most time, energy, and financially demanding healthcare issues in the country, and no less so in this region. Topping the list of challenges in most communities is residential or cared nursing services for those with dementia, both near-term and long-term, and the demands on those who provide the caregiving, often falling on the shoulders of family members or friends.
And what I think is important to do when that diagnosis is made is, you know, starting to draw in the caregivers and thinking about how this process is going to progress over time. Because unfortunately, as we know, we don't have a cure for the various dementia processes at this point.
Dr. Mary Bassing.
There are medications that can improve symptoms, slow things down a little bit, but there's not something that's going to reverse the changes. So it's kind of working with the patient and families as to, you know, what is this going to look like as we go through the next, you know, 5-10 years together and walk through this together. And it is very different between individuals, too. So it's not just one definition or one process.
And I think when people think long-term care, they think about a place like a nursing home.
La Crosse County Lakeview Health Center Administrator Wanda Plachecki.
But long-term care is really just a set of interventions and supports that we know are going to be need to be in place for a long period of time. But they can be, as Dr. Bassing said, as simple in the beginning as really working with the caregivers so that they know the kinds of supports that that person might need in terms of medication management or in just daily living skills. And then as that disease progresses, really understanding at what role a residential placement such as a nursing home or assisted living might be an appropriate discussion to have with that family. But it's more than just nursing home, which is what I think people kind of jump to when they think long-term care.
And Wanda, do you think that the mindset about how we care for people with dementia in the long term has kind of changed?
I think it is changing. When we think about that kind of care, we think about it in a very individualized way because as you are hearing today and as you know just in reading about the symptoms is that they're very different for each person. And so as we're looking at the kind of care that we provide, even in that assisted living and nursing home setting, we try to look at it as a set of supports along a continuum of services so that people don't get too many things that they don't need so that they are allowed to live the life that that they are choosing to live as long as they can, and that they are able to make decisions in what happens and what kind of care they're going to receive. So again, I think it's changing as people get more in tune to what those needs are for each individual, as systems are in place to provide that on a more individualized basis. I think it's getting better.
When the caregiving began about a year ago, my mom at that time was in a relationship and was being cared for well by the person that she was with at that time. But a major kind of event took place where she was disoriented and left a building, and we weren't able to find her, and eventually she was found many miles away walking home.
That's Chris Bergdahl of Vernon County sharing her family story of caring for someone with dementia.
And it was just one of those kind of events where it was decided, gosh, things are progressing and we need to find a different way to care for her. We need more help. So my sisters and I then began kind of taking each of our own turns and caring for her. And so that's kind of when it began. We each took a chunk of time and began caring for her in the best way that we could, which was wonderful. But at the same time, all three of us are kind of part of that sandwich generation, trying to care for my mom and care for our own children. So it just really became a big challenge trying to coordinate our own families and make sure she was cared for too. But that's kind of when it began, about a year ago.
Chris's story is not uncommon. According to Amy Brzezinka, the Caregiver Coach Program Coordinator for Western Wisconsin's Aging and Disability Resource Center, increasingly, family members are having to learn how to juggle their existing lives with the demands of being a caregiver, and it's not easy.
More and more family caregivers are adult children with children of their own and working, and as the parents are aging, they are taking on that role of caregiver and, you know, making phone calls from work and having to take time off of work and juggle all of that. And it can be very stressful and overwhelming for people.
And Chris, I don't know if you have, you know, tried to, in your experience as a caregiver, did you ever try to access resources through an ADRC or another program?
I did try a few things, and each of my sisters and I, you know, researched a little bit. But, you know, I have a full-time job and a part-time job and four children. And sometimes I would know about a meeting coming up or a group that I could meet with, but I really just didn't have the time to get there. And then we actually did kind of meet as a group and kind of start something like a Share the Care type program, but then felt a bit overwhelmed asking friends of my mom's, and we just kind of felt like, oh, you know what, we're just going to take it all on ourselves. It's just going to be easier that way, which it isn't, but we were kind of reluctant to reach out too much for help. So we knew about some ideas, but found it kind of difficult with our time restraints to really get involved.
A family caregiver once described dementia as a disease for the whole family, that it was something that, you know, the loved one's condition had really taken a toll on everyone in their family. Chris, do you feel like this description is relatable to your situation?
I do. I see, you know, when caring for my mom, not only did it affect, you know, the amount of time I had to spend with my children, but then there was also this pull where I noticed my mom needing me to be the one who gave her my full attention. And then a disconnect between she and her grandchildren where the children needed me and were looking for my attention, and she needed me and were looking for my attention. And when they both came to me at the same time, it just didn't work. So, and then there's, you know, the relationship between a husband and a wife when you just don't have time to talk even sometimes anymore because you're caring for your mom. And I think, you know, that's just within my own family. So I think each different person in the family is affected in some way, definitely.
I know that when you you know, are caring for a loved one with dementia, you know, sometimes you're faced with tough decisions that have to be made about the care of your, you know, your loved one, whether they should be driving or whether, you know, it's time to put them in a facility. And Chris, I don't know, were you ever faced with those really tough decisions? And
Definitely. Like the one that you mentioned about driving, you know, I can think very clearly of a day when my mom was driving and she drove from Westby to Onalaska and came back home hours later very upset. And, She said, you know, I went to go visit my daughter, Beth, and I couldn't find her. And my sister had moved a year earlier, but she had forgotten. And at that time, when she was very scared of what was going on, she stopped at a Quick Trip to ask for help. But she wasn't able to come up with what her daughter's name was. She wasn't able to come up with what the address was. She just knew she was lost, but she couldn't get help because she couldn't tell anyone who she was trying to find. She luckily knew the highway well enough to get back home, but yeah, then it was made the decision that day, like, driving is not going to happen anymore. And to see how that changed my mom, she knew she lost her freedom that day. And obviously it's for their safety, but it was so hard on her. And same thing with deciding when you need more care. We went through adult daycare, and we had individuals caring for my mom. And as the different behaviors kept changing, there were times that she would no longer go with another caregiver. She wanted me only, and there was nothing I could do to get her to get into a vehicle with another person that wasn't me. And then more behaviors of depression and anxiety, and then aggression towards her grandchildren. We want to be wonderful caregivers, but we also need to make sure she's safe and our families are safe. And that's when we really had to start looking into coming up with a facility, because things were progressing so quickly that we knew what we were doing probably just wasn't going to be enough for everyone to be safe.
We've been talking a lot about the emotional, the stress, you know, restraints on time, but, you know, have you experienced any moments of joy or positives of being a caregiver for your mom?
Definitely. There are those moments where maybe she's had a really bad day, and then I have to kind of dig deep and think, you know, what is it that she's always loved her whole life through? And for my mom, it's music. And so I you know, pulled out music that I knew from her past she loved, and all of a sudden her mood has changed. And, I mean, it's gone as far as we would joke over the summer that sometimes our days would be rough, but evening was a good time, and we'd told our neighbors, if you see a group of people dancing on our deck in the evening, this is typical. This is the best part of our day. And we put on music and dance, and I'd get my husband and my children out there dancing too. And those moments when she would come back to life, those moments are like just some of the most special.
That's Chris Bergdahl from Vernon County sharing about her experience as a caregiver for a person with dementia as part of our year-long series on issues related to aging. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Hope Kerwin. While there are challenges that come with growing older, many seniors maintain an active lifestyle. We talked about healthy aging programs with My Chore Lee, who runs the Smart Seniors Program for the La Crosse County Health Department, and Barb Schaefer, fitness director at the La Crosse YMCA, which offers a variety of exercise programs for seniors.
It's important in a lot of different ways. Obviously, staying physically fit helps you to just perform your daily activities that you do every day. You know, getting in and out of the car, you know, going shopping for groceries, you know, playing with your grandchildren. And it also helps to delay chronic disease. It helps with a lot of other health issues like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, helps people stay fit, keeps that weight off. So it's very beneficial, you know, from a physical standpoint, but above and beyond that, there's that emotional well-being that comes with the aspects of physical fitness. You're taking care of yourself. You're doing something positive. A lot of times you're in a group setting where you're in a group exercise class, so there's a strong sense of community, making friends, which helps you emotionally, helps that emotional well-being. So it's very important from a lot of aspects for seniors.
And My Chore, the seniors that, you know, come and participate in the Smart Seniors Program, is that more of a preventative, I guess, measure? Or are they starting to experience some problems with memory or other issues that typically come with aging and kind of wanting to address those?
The population that come to our program are usually, they are there for preventative health. They are there to prevent so that their brain fitness is still sharp. if there are some, I don't know, loss and cognitive delay in there, then I mean, ideally, this program is for prevention. So I am not sure if somebody has some sort of cognition already. I think they could still benefit from it. But I would say that maybe not as much as somebody who who is still very sharp out there. So I shouldn't say seniors. Ideally, maybe it's for somebody who is 50 and up.
My Chor Lee runs the Smart Seniors Program for the La Crosse County Health Department, and Barb Schaefer is fitness director at the La Crosse YMCA. Beyond being physically active, there are benefits to being active in other ways that are important for keeping the mind sharp as we age into our 70s, 80s, and beyond. Lifelong learning programs, book clubs, and many aspects of the arts contribute to this, sometimes for sheer pleasure and other times for intentional therapy, as we learned from Adrian Sweeney from Lanesboro's Commonweal Theater, Andrea Halverson, a music therapist from Life in Harmony, and Karen Misseldine of Decorah, Iowa, who works with adults in nursing homes or those with behavioral issues.
Art is used as a way to, you know, tap into the creative side of the brain. It's often seen as something that you're kind of coming through the side door or the back door instead of just the verbal communication, so using that nonverbal. So some people really work in an art as therapy approach, so the art itself is the therapy where the process is really focused on. And then there's other people that use art as psychotherapy and also people that combine those two. Art therapy is what has been called kind of the love child of art and psychotherapy.
And Andrea, I know that this kind of confusion can also happen in music therapy where people will, you know, kind of blur the lines between entertainment, music as entertainment, but also, you know, and music as therapy. Can you talk a little bit about the difference there?
Definitely, yes. I think a lot of the things that Karen are saying are resonating with me because they are some of the things that I encounter in my job, as the music is really about the process. And maybe from the outside, it looks like a jam session, or it looks like we're just playing music and having a sing-along with the client or the patient and maybe the whole family if we have everyone involved. But the music is targeting real functional goals, which could be cognitive goals or physical goals or social emotional goals. So we are very diligent about documenting the progress that we're making and that we're making progress toward a functional goal. And maybe a client may be obtaining some kinds of musical skills along the way. But our focus is really on that functional goal and providing some kind of service that is going to promote some cognitive development or emotional development in the client that we're working with.
And Adrian, you know, do you think that theater can also be a way to kind of, you know, escape things, whether it is a physical thing, pain or a mental or emotional pain that people might be able to escape when enjoying theater?
It's that opportunity to be mindful for 2 hours and to be present with something else that is not your pain, whether it's grief or actual physical pain, emotional pain. I believe, and I again feel strongly that it's also that sitting in a theater, being surrounded by other people, you're all experiencing the same thing, and that energy is palpable. It's very palpable. So to sit there for 2 hours and experience a story, whether it's a silly comedy or something deep and in depth and dramatic, you're sitting there and you're focusing and you are mindful. It is a mindfulness practice. And it certainly is for us on the stage as well. You know, we are very mindful in the moment. And then you're sharing that experience. And I truly believe that it's an opportunity to rise above, go away from, detach from the cares and the woes, whether they be mental, physical, spiritual, or otherwise. And I've actually had people say that. We've had patrons. I'm very fortunate to be part of a theater company that gets to know its patrons very, very well. I've had people tell us many times, you know, they're grieving over the loss of their spouse, and they're just thrilled to be back to the theater, and it's lifted their spirits. And yes, I'm sure the topic of the play may be a part of it, but I also think it's that focused communal energy and that being in the moment that is a bigger part of it.
Adrian Sweeney is with Lanesboro's Commonweal Theater. We also heard from Andrea Halverson, a music therapist from Life in Harmony, and Karen Misseldine, who uses art as therapy in and around the Decorah, Iowa area. We all age differently, and yet if there's one common theme, it may be that we all age better when surrounded by family, friends, and professionals, a community that cares, a thread that weaves uniformly through race, religion, and the many cultural communities that exist in our region. To close out our year-long exploration of aging in the Cooley region, we brought 60-somethings from various backgrounds together to share their diverse perspectives on aging. Cecil Adams is African American, Dan Green is a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation, and Catherine Schneider was born blind. But one thing they all have in common are lessons learned from their respective elders.
I've learned some patience. I tend to want to accomplish things right now. And when I learn a new piece of technology or a new skill, or when I'm dealing with a difficult, unfair situation, I've learned from elders that honey attracts more flies than vinegar, and Rome wasn't built in a day, and sayings like those, you can laugh at them, but at the same time, they're very true, that we shall overcome, and it really is someday, and it may not be right now like I'd like.
And Daniel, I would pose the same question to you. You know, what are some of the things that you've learned from elders in your experience?
My grandmother and my aunt, I could never go to their house. I could never go and visit without coming away with a present. They might not even know I was coming, but I'd show up, and so immediately we'd start eating, and I could see my aunt. She'd be looking around, what can I give him? You know, and she'd give me this beautiful beaded pendant, and I knew darn well it must have taken a month or more to make, and she didn't think twice about it. She'd give it to me because that's the way they traditionally believe, that you're supposed to constantly give and feed the people, so it makes them feel good. And by fortune, I've learned that also, that, yeah, it feels really nice to give.
And Cecil, you know, what are some things that you've learned from elders in your experience?
Well, my father was a believer in the rite of passage, and he had a few things up his sleeves that he measured that by. And one of them was, you need to know in front of who you stand. No matter what the situation is, if you're at school, if you're playing baseball, basketball, football, and you're talking back and forth with someone, or someone calls you in to the office and asks a question, know who that person is, what that person represents before you open your mouth. You know, are you Cecil? Yes, I am. And who are you? You know, be respectful, because that was, remember I told you, the respect was the key thing. And so he taught me that, to be respectful, but also know in front of who you stand. And my grandmother, which is on my mother's side, was an ordained minister. And her belief in God is what gave me that motivation to seek the truth, and our truth, you know. I'm not saying there's no other truth, but my truth. And she instilled that, and so I learned that, and I learned to bring others on board, not just to be the type, like she told me, don't be so heavenly bound that you're no earthly good. And that was one of her sayings that, as you see, still stuck with me. So I practiced that as well. And then on my father's side, his father, he was a little character, and I guess there's a character in every family. And he told me, if someone strikes you with a rock, he says, then you pick up a bat. And I said, okay. And if someone throws a shoe, he said, you pick up a truck. and you throw. So his thing was, if they approach you in, you know, in a negative way, in a way that's going to cause you a bodily harm, he said to prevent that from happening again, you strike back 10 times worse. Got me in a lot of trouble, but it also stopped the bullies. And I wasn't a bully because I wasn't taught to be that. So my whole upbringing was respect, know in front of who you stand, believe in your God, and don't let anyone walk on you.
Cecil Adams of La Crosse was a guest on the last show in our aging series, Aging Across Cultures. We've been taking a look back at our 2016 series on issues related to a growing population of people 65 and older. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.